Bubbles are necessary. Everyone keeps talking about a bubble. Through history, we've had bubbles, and they are a feature, not a bug. You know, it's quite logical for companies to say, I have to overinvest in AI, and I have to do so because if I don't, I become irrelevant. And so the game theoretic for them individually is to make decisions to try and hedge off their potential irrelevancy. And so they may overinvest. What that ends up doing, though, is it ends up overbuilding the infrastructure. Eventually, the bubble pops, but the infrastructure remains. So some people shape logic.
Yeah, but somebody else gets it. It goes to the rightful owners.
Correct. I mean, this happened to the
William Bernstein, you know, like equity winds up in the hands of its rightful owners, right? Like all that dark fiber, right. All that dark fiber that got overbuilt by Global Crossing and WorldCom is owned now by Indian companies. Yeah.
Yeah. But by the end of that, you could transfer data across the world in milliseconds.
Yeah. It's still there.
The railroad build out was the same. Was overbuilt. Yeah. Every town needed a rail spur. If they didn't have it, the town was going to be irrelevant. So every town built it. And at the end of the day, you know, a lot of that debt went away and bankruptcies occurred. But you could take a train from San Francisco to New York in a day or two, and nowhere else could you do that in the world. And so you had this massive infrastructure build that was still there as a result of the bubble. So bubbles are not a perniciously bad thing. They are a feature of capital formation. And then, as you say, the assets post bubble are turned over to folks at lower prices, and you actually have the rollout of more productivity based on that. So, you know.
But yeah, they have the effect of attracting enormous amounts of capital that wouldn't otherwise be attracted.
Correct.
In normal times.
All the optionality that we don't know what's going to work. Like, you didn't know what the optimal railroad system was across the U.S. You didn't know what the optimal fiber optic cable laying was. You just laid massive amounts of it, and then eventually it filled up, and all the optionality that you didn't know gets used in ways you couldn't imagine.
I'm Pierre Daly.
I'm Mike Filbert.
This is Raise Your Average. Picture a hardware store that has been owned by the same family for 60 years. It sells three kinds of hammers, two kinds of paint, and one lawnmower. It's comfortable, it's profitable, it's also gently a little boring. Now imagine someone walks in and says, what if instead of three hammers, you carried one for every job a hammer could possibly do? A framing hammer, a finish hammer, a sledge, a demo bar, a tack hammer, a rubber mallet, a roofing hammer, a geologist's pick. And what if every one of them cost less than anyone else on the block was charging just for one? That's roughly what Corgi ETFs is attempting to do to the ETF industry. Founded in 2025, the firm already has 197 ETFs and nearly $900 million in assets. It launched 28 funds in a single month, then 35 more. The product names alone are a press release: the U.S. War Machine ETF, the Coffee and Energy Drinks ETF, the Buy Now, Pay Later ETF. Corgi isn't trying to be everything to everyone through one big idea. It's trying to be the exact right thing for a very specific someone times 197. And Jeff Weniger just signed up to be the person who explains why any of this makes sense. He spent nearly a decade at WisdomTree as head of equity strategy, where his job was to take the raw material of markets and markets history and turn it into a story an advisor or investor could actually use. He's very good at it. Extraordinary, I would say. His charts show up in presentations across the industry. His macro calls get argued about. And now he has been handed a shelf stocked with leveraged ETFs, buffer strategies, thematic funds across quantum computing, drone warfare, genomics, and founder-led companies, plus some interesting treasury products at 5 basis points. And told, tie it all together. That is a rich assignment, and that's what today is about.
Well said, Pierre. I remember seeing the release where Corgi first came out and launched, you know, 30 ETFs at a time and beat them.
Pretty mind-blowing.
Yes, that's a small feat.
The razor-sharp precision of some of those names is particularly intriguing and exciting and curiosity building at the same time, because I'm sure Jeff's going to get into it. There's a lot of people who want exactly what they want, and they're wondering, you know, they were previous to this, obviously they were wondering, how can I get it?
Yeah. And I think in a world that we live in today, where you're thinking about, okay, well, there's large providers of market cap and thoughtful ways of low vol and equal weight. How do you differentiate yourself? So it'll be interesting to dig into that, as well as what Jeff's thinking on the macroeconomic side, and then trying to tie that into a world where we are in an explosion of innovation, where I think that's where, you know, Corgi might be targeting some very specific explore opportunities to complement the core.
All right, I'm back.
This is Raise Your Average, dedicated to making you a better long-term investor. Join us as we sit down with some of the most interesting names in finance to discuss macro, markets, investment strategies, and more.
Jeff, welcome. It's terrific to have you back on the show.
All right. Yeah, I'm ready to go. Thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate, you know, in the new shop, trying to get the word out. So it's much appreciated.
Well, perfect. Yeah, it couldn't be better. Jeff, you just walked through the door at a firm that is betting on that future, on betting that the future belongs to precision and specificity, not just breadth and blending. So, Jeff, before we get into the product shelf, I want to start where strategists always have to start, where you always have to start, with the world as it actually is right now. What's your read on where we are in this cycle and what the dominant risks and opportunities are, and what's maybe the market getting wrong?
Sure. And look, I mean, where we are in the cycle, does that mean summer 2026 and then it's totally different come September? Where we are, at least right now, is I almost suspect running it a little bit hot on the economic side, which maybe I say a little bit hot, maybe a lot hot for the economy. And that's one of the things that it actually could end up being a really good thing, because I think the gut instinct is, look, to the extent that the economy is surprising to the upside, or that there's inflation pressures to the upside, that would mean that Kevin Warsh is going to give us more than the one or two hikes between now and next summer. It was, okay, well, maybe that's what the Fed does, gives us three hikes between now and next summer. And the big question is whether or not the economy can maintain that, right? Whether or not that's something that can be digested. So where we are in the cycle is, well, first, fixing to get ready to get started to talk about hiking interest rates. And then also we need to hearken back to, and it might be a little bit different, but when Jay Powell was hiking rates, that was 500 some odd basis points over the course of, I don't know, guys, five quarters. And so that's one of those things that we need to make sure that we're at least thinking out loud about. It's like, can we digest an incremental 50 or 75 basis points over the course of 1 year, which is slow rolling it on overnight money? I think it's very doable. And I don't know that a lot of people are really thinking in those terms.
I also think that, you know, when you think about Warsh and the Fed, there seems to be a full overhaul of the Fed and the way they're viewing things and the information that they're using. If we think about the task forces that have been set up to start to think through what information is important, how this AI boom and the potential productivity may manifest, as well as the battle for capital between, you know, this idea that the government has to refinance a lot of the debt, as well as at the same time finance this massive capacity build out for this AI opportunity. And those two tensions are strong. And, you know, one of your tweets recently was on, you know, the long-term rate going up. And that can happen for a couple of reasons. One is, okay, there's uncertainty about, can the deficit be paid off? What are we going to get those dollars? How inflation adjusted are those dollars we're going to be getting back on a 30-year basis? But on the other side of that, we have massive capital opportunities to invest in, where the return on capital of those is greater than the potential cost of capital. And so when that happens, rising rates are not necessarily a bad thing. And that's one of the things your tweet pointed out is that, hey, long-term rates rising isn't bad for stocks generally. It hasn't been in the past. And then I look at some of the other tweets you have on, hey, how's GDP growing and where's the economic growth looking like and what's it looking like when we look into the future? And you see pretty strong numbers there. So it makes sense that long-term rates would be rising because you've got long-duration capital that needs to fund the AI build-out, and you want the sorting of those projects to be done at a rate where there's a hurdle rate that's appropriate.
Right.
If you keep that hurdle rate too low, what you get is overinvestment, and you get investment in things that, you know, can't meet the hurdle rate. And so you get misinvestment or malinvestment. So there's a lot going on there.
Ooh, a little malinvestment thrown in there. Is a Friedrich Hayek was just entering the room. Malinvest, yes. Yeah, that is certainly a concept that's being bopped around with the AI build out. And yeah, you know, Mike, this is one of these things on the backup in yields. So let's take the long bond back up. It's actually, guys, extremely orderly. And we caught a little bit of a rally here in the last few sessions, but in the grand scheme of things, when you're thinking about a comeuppance in someone's bond market, and look, this applies, I'm picturing in my mind U.S. bonds, but this is happening in German bunds, it's happening in gilts, it's certainly happening in JGBs, but I'm just speaking in those terms here on the big bond market, U.S. Treasuries. This is remarkably orderly, and then here's the big question that none of us know, we can only try to gauge, is who passed the law that said that we must attribute a sell-off in the bond market to necessarily bond market fears about fiscal profligacy? Was there a law passed that says that's why I need to be fearful of the bond market? How about the reason I'm fearful of the bond market is we have potential upside surprise to our economic numbers, right? Economic expansion, rising bond yields. Economic contraction, falling bond yields. And look, the strong counterpoint to my assertion here is, hey, Weniger, have you not noticed that in, I don't know, 4 weeks' time, the gold price has gone from 4,000 to 4,700 and settled back at 4,600? It's fiscal profligacy. And that is probably the best argument that someone can make, right? It's like, oh yeah, you're over here spouting off about GDP could surprise the upside into 2027 or something. Have you looked at the gold price? And so I don't really have a good counterpoint for that person. Gold has suddenly gotten some legs. Where's Bitcoin's up at like 80 again? Bitcoin has found, where was the bottom, Philbrick? Like 62 or 63K on,
I think. That might have been 57 or whatever.
62 was the...
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. So those people have a good argument. But what I've been pointing out in a lot of the macro imagery, I mean, look, if you think about what we're doing at CoreYi, right? New ETF issuer trying to get brand recognition. Let's go on social and put the macro charts out. Hope that stuff ends up in the daily shot, right? I mean, that's really what it boils down to. Hope that Meb picks it up in the idea farm. Right. And so if you look at a lot of the charts that we've been putting out, guys, last week, that Philly Fed print, general business activity, we had that in, now, is this a good or a bad thing? We had that in the 99th percentile of all time. Well, and that's a time series that's something like, 1968 to present on Philly Fed general business activity, 99th percentile. Now, there's asterisks on that. Usually when you've got an economy running hot, which is probably very difficult for a lot of listeners to conceptualize that this guy's on here talking about this economy running hot, because the topics of the day are the K-shaped economy where only the top X percent are able to spend, everybody else is against the wall. And I think we can go down a path of rents and home prices later if you guys want on some of these concepts. The no hire, no fire. What are you talking about? The economy running hot. Well, there's a manufacturing index from last week that was pretty robust. And I'm trying to back of the envelope it in my mind. S&P Global on the PMI for services and manufacturing. Those were something each 53 or 54. One of those, yeah. Two, maybe 55. I got to try to think of what they were. 53, 54. So that is not too hot, not too cold, but in expansion on the aggregate economy. And but the problem is when you have the Philly Fed up at 99th percentile, you start to say, well, that's usually when you want to think about getting out. Because the economy can only go sour from here. But when you look back at that data set, it's intriguing because it's not necessarily the best harbinger of future returns. But when it spikes, the notable spikes in that time series through history are pretty good entry points for either multi-year or multi-year engagement.
Yeah.
You had the big asterisk is it did it in 73. We know we had that nasty bear market in 73, 74. But you had 1983, this thing went up in 98, 99th percentile. And that's morning in America. And you're going to run this market from 1983 into August of 87, crash it in 87. So you have 4 years there of stock market gains. 1993 is another blow up in a good way on that time series. 1993, guys, that's what, 2 years before the Netscape IPO. So you're getting along 2 years before that even happens. And you're in a bull market in 93, 94. It triggered again in something like 2004. Stock market peaked in October of 07. And then it also did it in 2011, which if you remember 2011, that summer, that's when Greece was theoretically leaving Eurozone. And that was a nasty, we were down in that, it was nasty. That summer of 11, we were down like 19% in the S&P. It was just one of those swoons that's, as we age into this industry of realizing that was 15 years ago. Now, the other blow off is April of 21. Where economic activity was just getting so robust. We were still in a lot of those work from home plays. I mean, just to think about one that's in the news right now, Moderna. That was, I don't know, what was Moderna, like a 5 or 10 bagger at the time? All of that excitement. We were in the SPAC boom, the NFTs, that stuff of 2021. That's one of those, is this, it, are we too hot? Are we too cold? Because the you get this big print in some of these regional Fed activity surveys. Is that ugly? I mean, 2021, we're going to peak the NASDAQ in November of 21. We're going to peak the S&P 500 on January 3rd of 22. But I mean, you could really say we've got 8 months left in this if it was a repeat of that. So I'm heartened. I'm heartened by some of this stuff.
We need something to worry about, right? So the whole bond vigilante side of things is the thing to worry about. And at the same time, you know, you've got the actions taken in the off the run treasuries on the long end. But that to me has been more, the Fed is changing in my mind, but this is to be proven, more of a protect the plumbing Fed rather than to protect the price or set the price Fed. Previously, yeah, it was, hey, we're going to lower rates. We got to protect the price of assets. Right now, this is more surgical. It looks like we're going to protect the plumbing, but we'll let volatility occur. And Bessent, while his press conference was related to Iran, he stated that not one treasury bond had been purchased. And so we look towards September 9th to see what the activity is like. They also, you got the TGA, which is rumored to be potentially spending some money to support the yield curve, but we don't know that yet. These are all just jawboning at the moment.
Yeah.
And actions have yet to be taken. And so you look at that with this strong economic output that you refer to. And I as I said, long rates higher long rates is quite possible when you have, and quite actually preferable when you have investment opportunities on a long duration basis that have the returns to withstand that. And right now we've got a lot of long duration investments that need to be built and have pretty significant returns on capital. So I wouldn't get too bearish here at all. And you're going to need something to worry about for sure.
Yeah. Larry Adam over at Raymond James, he had a great headline this week, which we shared, which was rising yields may create opportunity rather than signal a bond market crisis. And I thought that speaks to what we've just spent the last 5 minutes, 5-10 minutes talking about, which is that instead of looking at rising yields as some kind of fundamental problem, how about looking at it as a great entry point.
Mm-hmm.
And we're starting to be an entry point.
Well, and Pierre, I think even with you, I've talked about this in the past. I mean, this goes back to Jesse Livermore writing under the pseudonym of Edwin Lefevre in the Reminiscences of a Stock Operator, and even How to Trade in Stocks. The book was called How to Trade in Stocks, the other one. And I remember back when I was at BMO, this was 15 years ago, I was at BMO, and one of my colleagues came in and was like, why do you have this book called How to Trade in Stocks? It's like Stock Market for Dummies. No, no, no. Listen to me. This is Jesse Livermore. This is 100-year-old. You got to read this. And it's actually really good reading to give a teenager or something like that, just the psychology of markets. Because through our careers, I mean, S&P hitting 1,000. I mean, now the S&P is at what, 7,700. But and I remember the S&P at 1,000, certainly the Dow 10,000 hats, which is the notorious thing. In the last, call it, what do you think, guys, 24 months or so, I do it because I'm a human being. 5% on the 10-year. We had a few spooks in the broad market on 5 and 10. What's the difference? It's just a round number, but it's a round number that has a 5 in front of it instead of a 4. I think we're at 465. Whether or not the market can withstand that. I mean, we also do things like we refer to that security as the benchmark security. The 10-year treasury, for whatever reason, is the benchmark security, not the 5-year. We just price everything off the 10. I think it's because Philbrick, this goes back to what you were saying with long duration assets. People never really realize that you compare in the United States, a 30-year mortgage to a 10-year piece of paper. People say, oh, shouldn't it be a spread of the 30-year mortgage to the long bond? Well, you could do that. You're more than welcome to do that. I do it all the time. I compare yields of things that are mismatched on duration all the time. It's no rule that says I can't do that. I mean, I make macro charts for a living. Trust me, I've tried every combo on the Y and X axes. But you do a 10-year. Call that a benchmark security because, well, you buy a house 2026, so you got until 2056 I'm supposed to service this mortgage. Well, I could croak, but I could die. I could get divorced. Let's hope that doesn't happen. She could leave me and that would be the end of that. I could sell the house. I could refi the house. And so, boom, the 10-year treasury is the benchmark security. And so what happens is we're sitting here every day, come in. I said 465. That's what it was yesterday. But as soon as I get off this podcast, I'm going to check a quote on the 10-year treasury. Mm-hmm. Because we're talking about it and somebody else is talking about it and hyper-focused on it. And I mean, you guys know as well as anybody when it comes to thinking about bond yields, and then making a connection to whether or not the stock market is going to go up or down in reaction to that is a very difficult errand. I know a country, I'm thinking of a country, we studied it for many years at the old shop, Japan. It kept interest rates at zero for a long time. It wasn't working very well. Right, that's the founding fathers of quantitative easing, right? Basically, they initiated QE in, I think, 1998. In Japan to try to stem a deflation of a bubble. And it didn't really work. It's a country that only got its act together really about 15 years ago, which, believe it or not, it's a long time ago. But is it the end of the world to go from 465 to 5? The market felt that way at periods of time in 23 and 24. But generally speaking, the bond market has been selling off gently. It has not been erratic. Something like the MOVE index, which is the VIX, like the VIX, but for bonds, is still very tame, certainly compared to the 2022 action. And it could just be that we should at least give credence to the argument that it's not 100% deficit to GDPs that's moving this, but it could just be that images of recession, fears of recession are ill-founded and we're going to be okay or satisfactory in 27. That's a very reasonable thesis, in my opinion.
I think when you think about Japan and you think about the great financial crisis, there was no investment opportunities. And the key thesis there is we need to work off this debt. We need to let the economy grow slowly. We need to work this off. We need to keep it manageable. And so you pin it at zero. That's mm-hmm. not the world we live in today. We live in a world of massive investment opportunities with significant return of capital that are based on this new AI boom that we have. Mm-hmm. And in order to make sure we allocate capital appropriately in a long duration sense, rising rates is not necessarily a bad thing. It actually is an allocation of capital mechanism. And I think the people at the Fed, Warsh and Treasury, Bessent, they have an understanding of that. And the rising rates do not necessarily mean it's a bad thing. If we can directly point to, no confidence in the fiscal regime, then maybe it is. But I'm not sure that's the case today. And I'm not seeing that is the case today. But let's see how the evidence unfolds.
Here's also, Warsh is probably a pretty
big mistake you can make.
There's also this additional idea, and I'm sorry, I can't pinpoint who it was that wrote it or said it, but all these capital gains that are arising from this market do have, I mean, if you know, you could focus in on some of the really big ones like SpaceX and NVIDIA, and but in general, because markets have been so resilient and strong and you know, returning 20% a year for the last 3 years and 15% over the last 15, there's a view that all that capital gain fills the tax roll as well.
Yeah, that's what they hadn't even really considered that. And you know, Pierre, you're tapping into this crowding out concept, which is usually a bond market concept, right? Oh, Oracle has to issue a ton of debt. And then, I mean, there's only so much paper that we can gobble up. I think that's a very legitimate concern that people have. And then, we're going to IPO SpaceX, and then we're going to IPO OpenAI and Anthropic. Can this market digest that? I mean, those are...
We're talking about trillions of dollars.
What's that?
We're talking about trillions of dollars in new wealth.
Trillions in free float, though, right?
Net worth.
Yes, in net worth. And then also, I mean, with SpaceX in particular, there's something, you guys got to help me out, is it like every 60 days, new locks unwind, and so more equity can come in and flood the market with that particular one. So these are...
It's largely worked out for them so far.
I know. And also, I mean, this goes to another concept. I'm trying to think, is it Cronert at Citi that has the concept of, he has a phrase for it, the de-equitization of U.S. capital markets through the years. I mean, many people put it forth, but there's somebody who's the face of the concept. I feel it's like it's that guy over at Citi. But basically the concept is you take an old index that has been basically forgotten, the Wilshire 5000. Right. Remember, people used to quote the Wilshire 5000, not so much anymore. I don't even know who owns the rights to it, but people forget that there's something like 3,400 listed stocks in the United States. There's no such thing as 5,000. I mean, unless you were to try to pull from the bulletin boards and the pink sheets, you can't get 5,000 names. And that's because the private equity houses have risen to prominence the last 25 years of taking people private or never IPOing them. In the first place, right? And this was essentially SpaceX got to multi-trillion dollar the market cap before we were able to even tap into it. And so does this end up reversing that de-equitization? So there's a scarcity with each passing year as 3,500 names becomes 3,475 and 3,450. There's not anything to purchase. And so you could theoretically push an aggregate multiple higher as that occurs. And this is a 25-year occurrence, right? 25 years probably. And then now, Pierre, here comes OpenAI. Here comes Anthropic, right? And that maybe that reverses it. IPO booms are not really necessarily a bad thing so long as they're not embraced by giddiness. And that's really something, one of those subjective things, guys. Has this been giddy? I mean, the SpaceX IPO is a flop. Right. I mean, I'm trying to think what the IPO price was, but once again, a company IPOs and is a flop. But that was met from talking to financial advisors, which is what I do, universal skepticism. Mm-hmm. Universal. The client calls the advisor, You know, I want to try to get a piece of this SpaceX. Those advisors, by and large, 99% of them said, stay away from that. And they did. So is that a giddy market when every financial advisor across this country is saying, be careful here? That's a market that theoretically is climbing a wall of worry.
Yeah, absolutely.
We ain't there yet. We're not. Hey, I lived through 2000. I lived through the boom in resource stocks in 07 and 08. People call this a bubble. And then you look at the earnings growth that has been happening in the S&P underneath the surface as we had this bubble. Take NVIDIA, the darling, trading at a peg of, 0.3, 0.5, 18 times future earnings and growing at 60%. I'm not sure that's the bubble that you think it is. I don't think you actually been in a bubble like pets.com. Now we're talking, right? We're going to ship you pets over the internet now, and we're going to have a Super Bowl commercial. Now we're talking bubble. Now we're getting there. Yeah. And
we've all had to do a lot of postmortem on .com through the years. And I always think about, especially 2021, really jumps out at me. And we always use this 1998 to 2000 window of time as, just because we haven't reached that yet, therefore we're cool. Well, just because we haven't reached the mania that is the most legendary, I think the most legendary of the last 500 years, just because we're not there. It's like, one time you drank 15 shots of whiskey, but I've only had 11, so I'm not there yet. So things are cool. Like, is that the point of comparison? In the 90s, this is before my time. In the 90s, I was in high school. People would compare stuff to the Japanese bubble of the 80s that peaked at the very end of 1989 because there was no .com yet. And what did they compare it to before then? I guess 1929 really would have been the point of comparison. So no pets.com and that type of thing. But there is another argument that the viewer should digest, which is, we were just talking about NFTs. Maybe this is because I'm at the tail end of Gen X and into millennial, but I always thought, and to this day think, NFT, this is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. This very concept seems ridiculous to me. The SPAC, just the absolute open season that the SPAC bubble was given in 2021. A lot of that was pretty wild. And then also, and here's the thing, Mike, if I know Philbrick didn't do it, but let's make believe he did. Let's accuse him of it. When Mike Philbrick bought pets.com.
Yeah.
So see how we could, if we say it enough, people will believe it. So when Mike Philbrick bought pets.com, he believed in the business model and believed that it would be a monopolist. And he believed that he was going to make a fortune when he did that.
It was such a great domain name.
If you bought GameStop in 2021, you bought it as a joke because you knew and admitted that you felt like it had no business model. And so which one's the bigger bubble? Who else was in that AMC with the they had the board apes, that concept at AMC? Tootsie Roll was in that. And the rationale for going long was they're spinning the drain. And isn't this hilarious that we're buying them? Whereas if you paid at the turn of the century for a name that has fallen from its perch, if you bought Yahoo at 200 or 300 times earnings, it's because you really believed, you saw the vision for search. You rightly saw the vision for search. You felt there was no Google. When did Google even become a concept? Like 04? 05, I bet.
Yeah.
Something like that. There was no Google. And we were just basically stepping away from Netscape to Yahoo. I guess we had Alta Vista. Remember Alta Vista? And so you never believed that Yahoo would control 80, 90% of search. Can't fault somebody for that in retrospect. It's easier to play Monday morning quarterback. And so what is the bigger bubble, 2021 or 99-2000? I don't know, guys. Sometimes I think some of the stuff I saw in 21 was pretty wild.
Yeah. Absolutely. Here's the other thing, though.
Yeah.
On the side, I totally accept. You don't have to get as wild as 2000. Keep in mind, 2000 wasn't as wild as the Japanese bubble. The Japanese bubble was 50% higher on its price to sales and price to earnings. So again, I think it's more thinking through the perspective investors have, right? So you talk about SpaceX. I agree with you wholeheartedly. There was an advisor that wanted to buy that, was telling the clients were calling, they were saying no, no, no. And so, you know, again, it's about the psychology of the market generally. And I'd say generally the psychology is pretty skeptical still, even though we're at, you know, pretty close to all-time highs across several market domains, even though we see broadening into equal weight versus market cap. If you look at value indexes, they're outperforming market cap substantially. If you look at international equities, again, outperforming substantially. And you see multiples that, you know, aren't crazy in those domains. And so when people throw around this bubble term, all I'm saying is from a reference point, I'm not sure that if we look at the market writ large, we're in bubble territory. And I have so many people telling me that we are. That's the other take where I'm like, yeah, I spend a lot of time with advisors and individual investors, and you know, mega crash is coming. You know, be careful out there. It's a bubble. I'm like, that's just not the ethos when we're in the bubble. When we're in the bubble, what people tell me is the opposite of that. It's going to grow, you know, trees grow to the sky. And I just, as my anecdotal evidence, as my N of one, that's not where we really are at the moment. But I mean, these are all great things to discuss and talk about and hypothesize. And, you know, it's interesting. We none of us know. We could go into a tailspin tomorrow.
Yeah. And that was a tailspin would actually be very good for the new shop that I'm in, because we need money to move. We need people to have some capital losses so that they could come over to Corgi. But you know, this is interesting with bubble psychology. You know, we going back to 1929, and when does the society that engaged stocks from, let's say, mid-20s to 1929 really get back into a bubbly mentality? I mean, maybe the electronics boom of the 1960s, I mean, which is a kind of a forgotten boom. Maybe I guess the first time you can really put your finger on something is the Nifty 50, which is a good, 40, 50 year, at least 40 years thereafter, because the heyday of the Nifty 50 is right before the 73, 74 crash. And just thinking about the psychology of it. So it's like, okay, well, all right, cool. After a legendary bubble in an asset class, it takes 40 years for another legendary bubble, says Weniger from 1929 to 1969. Well, okay. Think about Toronto. This is close to home, right? For you. Think about the Toronto condo situation. I mean, that metastasized for 20 years, really? And in my memory, my American memory, the U.S. housing bubble really from the money that was starting to be generated from the tech sector in the late 90s until about 04, 05. So you're going to bubble up another very risky asset class, condominiums. You know, that it's a real asset that you could take a loss on. It's illiquid. You're going to bubble that up very soon after the March 2000 peak in stocks. And then also, and then take that market, just to stick with U.S. housing, peak that out around 05-ish, crash it, and then get another housing bubble. Right. So if you're going to peak that in 05, crash that clear to like 2011, 2012, curve it around 2013, 2014 and get a recovery, and then just have a total speculative mania during COVID, that throws the 40-year stuff out of the window. Maybe it's 10 years. It's brutal to say, okay, you have a situation in 2021 as a bubble. How many years does it take to get back to a speculative mania? But the fact that I think it's forgotten among those of us who might not be as speculatively minded, right? So I've always been in an asset allocation pie chart framework for my entire career. And that pie chart got hit in 2022 on the fixed income and the equity side, but not hit nearly as badly as what might have happened to the psyche of the person who was doing it themselves and became a believer in the 2021 tape. There was a lot of stuff down 80, 90% in 2022. Can you get this B word bubble in 26 or 27 when that comeuppance was so recent in the exact same asset class? I don't know if I know the answer, but I think maybe not. I would assert that maybe for that reason, we're not in a bubble. But I'll lay it on you guys.
I like that. Yeah, I mean, that's
you like that?
Very interesting. Very interesting. But yeah, both of your points are well made. I think the point is that, you know, there's still an overwhelming amount of concern about concentration, about valuation. Mm-hmm. And some of that valuation concern, frankly, was, you know, got compressed, right? I mean, we had compression in valuations because of strong earnings. And so, you know, when everything that's happening and the prevailing sentiment is concern and worry, that's very encouraging to watch. Because I mean, as a contrarian signal, that's very encouraging. If people were, you know, hog wild crazy about investing in the concentrated market in mega cap, which they aren't, they're investing all the same, but they aren't excited about paying those prices because they've been, right. You know, a lot of the prevailing conversation is, you know, paying very high prices for stocks does not lead to great long-term returns. So people are not excited about that. They're worried about it.
Yeah. And also, I mean, you know, you guys know, I mean, I traffic in macro charts, right? So this is the subjective part of the conversation. We got a chart for everything at this point. I've been doing this so long. But I've also given some thought to this concept. We at any given time as an industry have a nickname for some group that we're talking about. And there's a million of these. There was the PIGS, PIIGS, mm-hmm. Portugal, Italy, Ireland, Greece, and Spain. These were the Eurozone exit countries. There was the BITS, right? The current account deficit emerging nations, Brazil, India, Indonesia. This was 15 years ago. The FANGs. You may remember the BATS. Baidu, Alibaba, and Tencent. We were talking about the bats for a good year or so, 5 or 6 years ago. I referenced the Nifty 50. You have a bubble when the acronym or the catchy name that somebody created is necessarily bubbling higher. Newsflash, the Mag 7 as a collective has been chopping sideways for like 6 or 8 months. There is no giddy tape on the Mag 7. They're just chilling. They are just chilling out as a general rule. So the thing that we are talking about frequently, the S&P 7 and the S&P 493, is not in that type of territory. The thing that's been tech in general, we got a relief rally in the software and that type of thing, but energy's on. Energy was left for dead. Energy was left for dead basically from the GFC until really the Russian invasion. And then you also had the side note in within energy, which was our industry's great move into ESG, which was shunning energy first and foremost. And now the question mark, how fast or how slow it might be moving away from some of the ESG concepts. I know that, I mean, for example, in Europe, I still think ESG is pretty much game on, but I know in the United States, in the institutional space, I mean, it kind of opened the door for more energy investment, classic fossil fuel concepts. And that's what easily in the last year, energy is probably a 45, 50%. Granted, you got Hormuz going on. That's why, but the market leader is certainly not anything that anybody's been bubbly on for the last 15 years.
Well, when I think about the, you know, you got capability, capacity, and capital in an AI boom. So AI's capability, the capacity, how do we build it out? The oil energy market falls into the capacity section, and look at copper, all-time highs. Mm-hmm. Look at the copper miners, look at the metals and minerals, and look at the allocation within the S&P 500 to energy and mining. It's de minimis. In 2008, the largest holding in the S&P 500 was Exxon. It's now number 14, and the whole oil and gas sector is like 3.5-4% of the S&P. Mining is less than that. And that's the capacity that those are the inputs to the capacity that needs to be built to facilitate the capabilities of this potential AI boom that we're having. Now we got to finance all of that. That's a whole nother letter C, but you know, nobody's in that, and it is far stronger than the other parts of the market. Anyway, it's interesting observation for me.
Well, you know, you got a macro pod and somebody just brought up copper.
Yeah, I did.
You know, Mike, I look at the doctor and it's sometimes the doctor needs to get a new diploma. Dr. Copper is not the greatest indicator, but I look at it a lot, and I'm going to back of the envelope that we're at 6.5, 660 or something on the doctor. Okay, so everybody knows Dr. Copper is it's old macro hands call that. We call it that because the copper price will often tell you what's happening in general, really historically heavy industry, right? Price is going up. There must be some sort of mismatch between supply and demand because the big proverbial smokestack company is demanding it. And then therefore you can with confidence get into industrials and cyclicals. That's the 22nd explanation why someone like Philbrick might be talking about copper. Hey, that copper chart looks pretty good, Mike. Pretty good.
It's crowded. It's crowded.
I'm trying to think. Where's the low in copper on that multi-year chart? You got it on the other screen? Are you cheating?
I could look it up quick. I could cheat, yeah.
It's a nice up and to the right 45-degree angle. It's had some fits and starts. And look, you know, gold decided to open up the first and second quarters ice cold. Silver did that crazy Hunt Brothers move and then retraced. But those two are monetary and silver's monetary and industrial, right? But copper really is the industrial metal. And it's saying good things. And look, to say that the economy is going to look great in the second half and into the first half of 27 is not really a wild call. I mean, there's not a lot of people calling for recession. So it's not like we're having this thing, you know, it's the first or second quarter of 2020, and it's a little bit bold to say that you're going to have economic expansion. So it's not really an uncrowded view to put this forth. But, Mike, here's the thing. Trump, Warsh, Bessent. Right now, in terms of moving the tape, Bessent is every much as important as those first two guys. In terms of moving the tape, that might change in a few weeks. I mean, you know, we got Bessent talking about China, but I'm talking about the big thing we started the pod with, guys, which is he's trying to maybe do an Operation Twist, whatever we might end up doing. On a year-over-year basis, U.S. GDP, second quarter, real GDP, was a 2.1. All right? 2.1. And then, I mean, Empire Fed looked pretty good, too. So, and I was talking earlier about Philly Fed. So here's some regional surveys that are doing pretty well. We talked about the PMIs, they're in expansion. So let's not go boldly. Let's say real GDP sometime in the near future, in the interests of growing out of the debt burden a la Bessent, 2.5, guessing, random guess, 2.5 on real GDP sometime in the next few quarters. And maybe 2.5 is the number. The print on CPI with all of its flaws is 3.4. All right, we're just going to go with CPI. We're not going to go with PCE. 2.5 plus 3.4, 5.9. The whole thing is predicated on all of us saying, Scott Bessent, you're ridiculous. We can't grow out of this. Well, if the deficit to GDP ratio, as ugly as it is a sixer, and nominal GDP is growing around a sixer, hey, debt burden goes sideways. It's a
Yep.
Crappy situation. But that's not the end of the world. When, and this is one of these things, I need to pull like a B of A Merrill fund manager survey. I haven't looked at it in the most recent. I'm going to guess just from being around, there are no bond bulls. Relief rally in fixed income could be very, very live in the next few weeks. I don't know if you guys have a finger on the pulse for bond market sentiment, but nobody's bullish on the bond market right now.
Yeah, not, nope.
Right? And maybe...
Yeah,
maybe
there are some. Yeah, I mean, people, some folks are starting to say, well, I don't know about this troubled bond market. It looks like an opportunity, like, right? That's starting to emerge, that thought, which is like, a few years ago, it was Ken Griffin at Citadel got asked, you know, what did he think was the most striking feature, like most surprising thing about the market? And he said, you know, 60-40 could come back. And yeah. Right. And the idea was that, you know, at that point, obviously yields had reached that interim high, and same idea, which is that the more, you know, when the price is right, the opportunity is there, but people are not feeling like buying bonds right now. Nobody's feeling like I got to get into long bonds.
And people want to have a view like, hey, Weniger, what's your view on such and such asset class? And sometimes it's okay to say, I'm neutral on something or to say, hey, we're talking about the bull case and the bear case. How about the other case, which is 465 in a 10-year? We wake up, it's Thanksgiving, and it's, surprise, 465. How about that? Right, it's going to chop around plus or minus 20 basis points and end up at 465 at Thanksgiving. That's pretty nice for equities, because that is, I think, the number one thing that the bears are pointing to right now. The bears are latching on that. And... I mean, that's probably the most live scenario showing out here about 4 5/8 on benchmark securities. You know, that CPI number at 3.4, I've been saying this for years. I think a lot of people know it if you're giving any attention to CPI. Right now, you guys know I've oftentimes done the housing stuff through the years. I think housing deserves more focus by macro people. Prince, in the last week or so, you guys know Apartment List? Apartment List has, it's like an aggregator of apartment rents. It was like, I guess if you're looking to rent something, maybe you find these 100,000 apartments on Apartment List. They have a time series. I look at it a lot. Apartment rents in the United States, minus 1.1% year over year. This is that K-shaped economy stuff I was talking about. Mm-hmm. The landlord has no leverage over you, generally speaking, in this country, in the United States. The FHFA home price index was low twos, if not two even, on a year-over-year. Case-Shiller, which is now the S&P CoreLogic, blah, 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 index, plus two. One of them was 2.3, one was two. In the CPI report, because it's still catching up the old COVID gains from home prices, both rent and owner's equivalent rent plus three on a year-over-year basis. So our CPI says 3.4, but the real number might be something more like, I mean, those combined to be a third of CPI. It's more like high twos. So, all right, if real life CPI, which, I mean, you know, there's hedonic adjustments and there's a lot of pushback and a lot of stuff, but let's say it's high twos or three. And the Atlanta Fed wage growth tracker is 3.8. And K-shaped economy is in the conversation. Well, you are outpacing inflation. People give you hell for saying that, but that is really what the situation is. And if you're getting 465 on a T-note and inflation's like three, is there any real compelling reason to sell that off immensely or buy it immensely or just let it chill out here at 465? We can get 165 over. That's a middling type thing. So maybe bond market stability is in the cards.
I like it.
Certainly looks like it.
Yes. Yeah, we'll see. We'll see, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Crystal ball stuff. It's just so easy, Mike.
But if the, like, so if you've got like, it's so easy. Yeah, absolutely. If you,
we don't make mistakes around here. We get right every time. So.
Well, that's. That's not a consensus view. That's a non-consensus view, right? Most people think that things are going to get worse in terms of bond market fragility.
But if it's stable, if the base case that we're talking about here is a stable bond market that, you know, that moves ever so slightly in either direction, mm-hmm. then what's the, you know, that leaves room for the actual opportunity in the price. Like if you're paying the right price for the bonds and you're getting you're locking, if you're actually going to hold a 10-year or 30-year to the end, yeah. you're getting that yield, you're getting the term premium. But something very positive could happen for bonds if there's any sort of risk off event, right?
Yeah. And then that's the
so you get question. That convexity.
Is it the reason that risk off event occurs? Is it stemming from a bond market puke like Gilt-mageddon from a few years ago with the UK budget? Gilt, not G-U-I-L-T, as in we're talking UK gilts, G-I-L-T, gilt-edged. Is it that? And that's going to be really problematic. Or is it something like, you're talking about Philly Fed surprising the upside, that lays an egg next month. And now it's more of a disinflationary situation. And then you have this whole back and forth with Iran is in the conversation too. What would it be? The weird thing about the deflationary shock in the back part of 26 would be there theoretically resolution to a war. And is that a bad kind of deflationary shock? Certainly not. Shipping gets lubricated again. We got serious issues in container shipping right now due to these pathways being closed. It would be a situation where the quote-unquote deflationary shock is something that is widely celebrated, right? No more guns and butter, that type of thing. And additionally, something for someone to consider. Why is there a 6%? Is 6% deficit to GDP ratio, something like that in the United States? Why? Well, because there's a war machine going on right now. And to the extent that you could at least prognosticate, theoretically, lower out year growth in U.S. military spending, that itself would theoretically calm the nerves of the bond market.
Should we take a pin in this here? Because I'd love to talk a little bit about the Corgi thesis and all the things that you've got going on there, too. So I want to make sure we have a little bit of time for that.
Sure. Yeah. I just came over to Corgi. This is my eighth day on the payroll at Corgi. I'm a guy that spends a lot of time, spent a dozen years at BMO, and then I was at the Tree of Wisdom, which is a great shop for 10 years, 10 years of Wisdom Tree. And it's tough leaving those guys because, you know, Mike, you've worked with them through the years. Pierre, you've had them on the show. I mean, brilliant guys and great products over at Wisdom Tree too. And I'm here. I'm in downtown Chicago. I got white walls. We haven't even decorated the place. It's so new. It's Corgi's really a San Francisco operation. It's a tech startup. It's a unicorn. And the unicorn decided to launch ETFs, and it's up to 197. And I think what's going to be really cool is we're going to launch a lot of very, very category killer type ETFs this autumn. Every category, we're going to have something, and they're going to be pretty cheap. They're going to be beta. There's going to be large blend, large value. There's going to be EM, small. There's going to be factors, all of it. And you guys know, I mean, this is shop talk, but the biggest thing when you have a company in the first inning is getting people aware of your existence, right? So we're going to have, by the end of the year, hundreds and hundreds of ETFs. Our asset base is still below $1 billion, right? The objective would be to scale this up. If we're going to compete on expense ratio, which is so easy to go up between Vanguard and BlackRock on expense ratio, among others. So we don't hold any false illusions about how difficult that venture will be. It will be a process, but getting the word out. And I think that there's going to be a lot of raised eyebrows when they see when those that we are filed can't talk about them because they're just filed. When they come to fruition, I think a lot of very fee-sensitive people are going to say, whoa, okay, who are these guys? I think I've seen that guy on Twitter. I see that guy's macro charts. Okay, I'll take the meeting. Yeah. And hopefully we can win business that way.
Well, and maybe if you could just walk through the lineup, because you've got several categories. So you're coming out with lots of beta stuff, going to be cheap and cheerful. You've got leveraged ETFs, you've got defined outcome products, and then you've got some really interesting thematically based, very narrow, and sort of shooting with a
with a rifle,
a great names, and you know, they hearken to the sort of social investing Peter Lynch type scenario where, you know, you like the war machine, or you like energy drinks, we're your guys. And so maybe walk us through those broad based lineups and whatever you want to sort of dig down into on a broad based level there.
Yeah, there's, I think we have 36 thematics, and then that is the point. I mean, we had an event last night and the advisor said, answer me this question. Does the world need another ETF? Right, there's 5,000 ETFs. And so what we did with the thematics, which I suspect that our core business by 27 or 28 is going to be the beta concepts. But with the thematics, those are at 35 basis points generally, and they're very, very niche. You know, aesthetics and beauty would be a concept. The war machine, as you mentioned. Now, I think one of the areas that's really appealing is if you look at what is essentially an oligopoly in buffers. And I know you two guys know buffers, but just for everybody's edification, what a buffer is, is you wrap an ETF around, we're going to write calls, that's going to cap your upside on something like S&P 500 tracker as the underlying. But in exchange for that, we buffer the first X percent of your downside. Do you like that? Yes or no? If the person says, okay, it tends to be somebody who would go into an annuity, right? They don't want to have pay the surrender fees on annuity, or somebody who says, look, I'm getting up there in age. I don't need to make 35% this year if the S&P melts up. I'm content capping at 16, 17, 18%, so long as just don't give me .com again. Don't give me 08. And that's the buffer business. And I think, well, we'll see, right? Because it's a very young business, but we're at 30 basis points on the buffers, and the key players are at over double that expense ratio. And it's a commoditized lineup. If you really think about it, I guess somebody called me on the phone here. If you really think about it, it's flex options. Everybody has very similar structures. And so we think that we can pry some of that money away from some of the existing buffer relationships, but also maybe it's the new money. And then this is where, I mean, this is ETF industry. So I got the Todd Sohn. I'm sitting here, hey, Todd, looking at your 2021 thing. You know, Todd was saying, 0.6% of the entire ETF industry is buffers. And it's something like $100 billion. What if $100 billion comes in this year and people are saying, give me a buffer, let me sort by expense ratio? I think we're going to get our chunk. I really think we're going to get our chunk. So I think in the 26, 27 business lead buffers.
Yeah. The buffer industry is very popular, especially with sort of the more senior Xers and the boomers, where they're looking at, hey, I want to participate. I'm nervous. You know, we had a whole discussion about, are we in a bubble or aren't we in a bubble? The buffered ETFs give a great solution to that, where you're not going to lose your shirt, but you'll participate in the upside to some extent. And that is a very popular mindset, and being able to bring that en masse to the industry at half the price, I think is going to be very interesting. I'm interested to see how that works out. I think that's a really good, you know, way to come to market and try to get some market share. And I think that'd be an area of growth too. As you say, you get a little bit of volatility, you get people a little bit nervous, but they need, you know, some returns. It's a good way to do things. It solves a problem.
Yeah. And also remember, I mean, we're in a raging bull market. And so sometimes people aren't necessarily so focused on downside until the downside hits them. And so that's another portent where people start saying, you know what, did I really need to be X percent long equities? And I felt the full brunt of that downside. So I think there's definitely a market for it. It's something that'll really help asset allocators too, in terms of risk budgeting. And I think it makes a lot of sense there's a ton of people. I'm thinking of somebody in my family. It's like, I know you've heard the statement before from your brother or your sister. I know that the day I get into the market is the day things are going to roll over and crash on me. It's the psych of this. Well,
yeah.
All right. How about you get into the market, and if this thing goes so high, you're not going to make as much as everybody else. In fact, they're all going to leave you in the dust. But if it goes plummeting, you got the first X percent. It's usually 10, sometimes 15%. buffered, it gets mitigated, and you'll just have everything beyond that. People say, okay, I can do that. And so I think it's a nice little business. I think that's where we're going to be in 26, 27. And I think, you know, we'll be able in 2027, I think, to ramp up the conversations on the beta products.
I thought it was mind blowing to see 197 ETFs launched in a year.
Yeah.
Dozens of months.
A lot of people want to box it into the individual stock. There's the 2X moves on the individual stocks and the lever, and that's not for everybody, right? That tends to be someone who wants to, who has the opposite of the type of person who's in the buffer, right?
So exactly. It's everybody.
And then we have the thematics, but really, I mean, I want to go after people's allocations to EFA, people's allocations to emerging, the stuff that really shows up in the pie chart. And I think we will. I think we're going to get our share because I think the expenses are going to be extremely compelling. We have reason to believe that there are a lot of legacy products out there by major fund houses that are sitting out there milking expense ratios that were cheap in 2000, cheap in 2005, not so cheap anymore. And I think we're going to come in for some of those line items and give them a shot. And you guys know as well as anyone, the top X number five, top five players in ETF asset management are household names.
Yeah.
They have brands that are forces to be reckoned with. And we're corgi. Nobody's heard of us yet. So we're going to make people hear of us.
Yeah. Well, to your point, on the milking, right? Just to your point, there's SPY and then there's SPYM. And SPYM is, State Street. Lower MER than SPY because they know they have some people trapped in SPY with capital gains, and that selling that to try and get a lower fee is, from a taxable perspective, not doable. And so they launched a product at a lower fee. They didn't lower the fee on the product, the cash cow they have today. And so this is the idea of money in motion. And so investors should be mindful and aware of the different products and making sure that they're, for the same exact product, you should be actually going for the lowest price.
Absolutely. Right. And that's basically where we're coming from. We're talking to some index licensing houses on the future launches, and we're going to basically say, hey, look, we're not claiming to be anything that we're not, right? I mean, the funds are listed as active because to the extent that we are actively, big air quotes, actively selecting which companies qualify to fit into the category, which is a big difference between active management that says, I'm bullish on Amazon, I'm bearish on Amazon, let me over underrate it. We're going to be very, very clear. We're not saying anything about Amazon. Amazon fits the description of consumer discretionary. It's in.
Yeah.
Right? Amazon is one of the 500 largest companies in the United States. It's in. It's going to be cap weighted. And by the way, here's the expense ratio. Would you like to take a meeting? It's as simple as that. And you guys know, with advisors, I mean, getting the meeting is step one. And I think we'll get our share. We'll get our share.
Yeah, on that front, I mean, I think what's exciting on that front is the granularity that you're offering, which is the being able to pinpoint the exact spots that investors want, rather than trying to make that round peg fit into the square hole, for everybody. I think when somebody is particularly interested in the U.S. war machine or, was a buy now, pay later, I thought that was,
Right. I mean, if the theory would be, if you are live, or if you're keen to buy now, pay later as a thematic concept, is that going to be 5 years from now? Is that going to ever be our biggest product? Does anybody among the three of us think that?
No.
But
probably not.
As people look for a pure play on that, they'll come to it. They'll find
but it. It's
the beta ones.
Yeah, it's a trend, and buy now, pay later gets talked about every other day on media.
Yeah.
They're looking. They're using that as some indication of consumption trends, right? Mm-hmm. And so if you're hearing that buy now, pay later keeps growing and growing and growing, and it's like buying. It's like deciding I'm going to invest in Visa and MasterCard. Because, they're just collecting service fees and they've got, X number of defaults But look at the cash flow on this thing, right? I mean, I think when you look at buy now, pay later, it's a similar idea to you know, an old idea, but it's the new brand of financing that can, you know, young consumers are using mostly.
Yeah, if you think about legacy, so to get really, really technical, inside the S&P 500, people like the three of us, we talk about GICS level one, that's the 11 sectors, and then there's GICS level two, that's like 25 or 30 sub-industries and sub-industries of that and sub-industries of that, how you slice and dice these. And so let's say, Pierre, that someone is keen on specifically that corner of financial services. In the earlier days of ETFs, you're kind of stuck with the broad financial sector, JP Morgan and Morgan Stanley, but maybe you don't want JP Morgan and Morgan Stanley. You truly wanted to be, you yourself viewed this as being a specific thematic. This is where things are going. I want exposure to those names. And what we're saying is we don't have an opinion on any of these companies, but these right. are the companies we'll get you the exposure and do it at a reasonable expense ratio. Because I think a lot of people come in and launch thematics and then they try to milk you on a big number because, hey, take it or leave it. I think what we're coming more is, hey, you want it? All right, cool. And I don't think we're going to knock your socks off when you take a look at the expense ratio. I think you're going to be okay with this. You know, these pretty cheap thematics. And on the buffers, guys, half.
Yeah.
Half for basically, what the heck is the difference?
Yeah. Well, what would you say is your favorite holding on the core shelf right now? And why? Is it the buffers, you think? Or what, or something else? What's your favorite on the shelf today?
I think my favorite is the one that I think we have the best shot at winning business in the near term, as opposed to I'm bullish or bearish on one. I'm thinking of a massive competitor product that is charging nearly double us on 0 3-month T-bills. Okay. It's 9 basis points at the competitor. What happens is people say, I want 0 3-month bills. And then they go and they look at the big three oligopoly and say, what do these people have to offer me on 0 3-month bills? You know, we had that issue at the old shop. Like, hey, great products at the old shop, right? But sometimes you're running up against these formidable foes. And, you know, it essentially is 0 3-month bills. Vanguard has 0 3-month bills. iShares has 0 3-month bills. They also have money market-ish type ETFs. But, Mike, we're under iShares on 0 3-month bills.
There you go.
What is there to it? It's tracking a FTSE 0 3-month bill. And every basis point matters. This goes back to what we were talking about with the bank walk when SVB was going under. And people are saying, I'm still sitting over chilling in this Chase bank account paying me 49 basis points. And Jay Powell had money at 5. And people were missing 450 basis points by simply just not moving from Chase to a high yield savings account. And what we're basically saying is, you want 0 3-month bills? How about us? 5 basis points, not 9. Yeah. So that's my favorite right now on the fixed. Hey, Weniger's in here on the fixed income side now, Mike. How about that?
I'm going to have to look at that for our treasury over here. 9 basis points and I don't have to do the rolls. Perfect. I'm in.
All right. Hey, man, that's what I'm talking about.
That's an interesting sweep.
Yeah. We're 5 across the treasury business. There's 6 ETFs. I got the guys are on the other side of this wall. The ones that are formulating which new products, and that's index licensed too. That's FTSE. So that's also the very known quantity. It's FTSE tracked situation. And you know, and out in the longer end, 20 plus years, for example, there's stuff sitting out there at big fat expense ratios. Well, we'll see. We'll see if we can come and get them.
I like it.
All right, cool. Once again, I mean, you know, get your viewers here. I mean, we're really trying to get the word out. So, you know, I called you last week, Mike. I said, hey, man, you know, I've known you for years. And so, guys, once again, I appreciate you putting me on the pod.
Well, Jeff, we love you. We love having you on. You know, you probably, you know, I said it in the introduction, but you're probably one of the greatest at telling the stories of the market. And
thanks, man.
We've absolutely enjoyed every single appearance of yours. I mean, just, you know, you're making it, not only are you making it insightful and interesting, but it's fun. You're fun.
Well, I appreciate it, Pierre. And look, we love markets, right? I mean, you guys are living this stuff. It's fun. Oh, we're geeks and we love this stuff. So I enjoy it and I appreciate it, fellas.
100%. Appreciate you too.